This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Douglas Impuga in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Given the uncompromising stance adopted by the medical doctors, government through the Health Service Board, and has come to the point where it has to commence disciplinary proceedings for the striking doctors.
That's Zimbabwe's Minister of Higher and Tertiary Education, Professor Amon Murira, on the government's pursuit of disciplinary action against doctors who are refusing to work. Also, Botswana braces for a closely fought election on Wednesday. Protesters march in Khartoum and other cities to mark the October 1964 uprising that ended a dictatorship, and rights and education activists call for the registration of all schools. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's a lot more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Botswana is bracing for a closely fought election on Wednesday as the ruling party faces its toughest challenge since independence from Britain in 1966. But on the eve of the poll, the main opposition coalition has expressed its concerns over what it calls government institutions' interference in the electoral process. From Gaborone, Botswana, Mukondisi Dube reports.
Botswana will go to the polls on Wednesday against a background of rising hostilities among rivals. Known for its relative peace and stability, Botswana finds itself preparing for a potentially bruising election. The ruling Botswana Democratic Party has won every election since the country became independent in 1966, but this vote could break that streak. Bitter words have been exchanged at campaign rallies, largely after a surprising fallout between former President Ian Khama and his hand-picked successor Mokgweetsi Masisi. Duma Boko, the president of the main opposition coalition, the Umbrella for Democratic Change, UDC, has accused government oversight bodies of trying to influence the vote in favor of the ruling BDP.
We, at some point, had to write to the Independent Electoral Commission, raising a number of concerns. The first of these concerns involved the overbearing involvement of certain agencies of government.
The party says actions by the National Directorate on Intelligence and Security Services may have compromised the credibility of the election. Directorate officials have denied interfering, saying the organization is fulfilling its duties. President Masisi has had his own harsh words. He told reporters in Gaborone on Monday there's a possibility of a civil war. He says the Botswana Patriotic Front, BPF, which his former ally Khama formed, has the hallmarks of being a rebel movement.
There is evidence, rudimentary as it might be, that particularly the party of the BPF is beginning to form itself into a vigilante and potential rebel movement.
Khama has in turn encouraged voters not to give the party he left early this year a fresh mandate. Professor Zibanani Maundeni, a political analyst, says Khama's switch to the opposition could prove key in the election.
He has been actively campaigning, moving around the country, canvassing support for the opposition. This is likely to give the opposition a better chance to win power for the first time in Botswana.
This week, parties finished up last-minute campaigns to lure voters. President Masisi will cast his vote Wednesday morning in his home village, Moshupa. Polling stations open at 6 a.m. local time, and full election results are expected on Thursday. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
Protesters marched in Khartoum and other Sudanese cities yesterday to mark the October 1964 uprising that ended a dictatorship. The marchers, however, focused on the present and made demands that stem from the recent ouster of former leader Omar al-Bashir. Naba Mheddin reports for VOA.
Thousands of Sudanese rallied Monday to mark the October 21st revolution that ended the rule of Ibrahim Aboud in 1964. They used the occasion to demand an independent investigation into the June 3rd massacre, when dozens of people were killed as military forces cleared pro-democracy protesters away from the defense ministry in Khartoum. Monday's demonstrations were backed by the Sudanese Professionals Association, which organized the protest that swept Omar al-Bashir from power earlier this year, but they were initially organized by neighborhood committees and the families of the June 3rd victims. Crying and holding a Sudanese flag, protester Snagla Mohammed said she is pessimistic the current military civilian ruling council will get justice for the victims. People took to the streets because they are still so angry, she says. Justice for victims isn't sustained. We reject any kind of military representation in the new transitional government. It's a total rejection, she says. And we also call for justice for the victims, as they were sacrificed for Sudan and nothing has changed. The dissolution of the National Sudanese Congress Party was another one of the protesters' demands. The party supported Bashir for decades. The Freedom and Change Alliance published a communique asking the protesters to drop the idea, warning that chaos could erupt if Bashir supporters attacked the protests. Protesters Ahmed Nasir says Bashir, who is facing corruption charges, needs to be punished for his dictatorial 30-year rule. This protester, Ahmed Nasir, says yes, they have a civilian government they demanded, and he's optimistic of the positive change will happen in Sudan. But for now, none of our other demands has happened yet. He's angry that Bashir is being prosecuted for money charges. He says Bashir should be tried under the constitution for the military coup he led. Ahead of the march in Khartoum, Sudan's military published a communique warning protesters and citizens not to get close to the army headquarters and military facilities. Troops spread across the capital to protect strategic locations. Sudan erupted in mass protests in December 2018 over high bread prices, but the demonstrations quickly morphed into calls for Omar al-Bashir to step down. Power-sharing agreement between the generals who ousted al-Bashir and protest leaders was signed in August to end 8 months of turmoil and lead the country until elections are held in 2022. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
It's day 51 since public service doctors were on the job in Zimbabwe. They say they are too underpaid to even afford to go to work. They have turned down salary increase offers from government, calling them insufficient to keep up with rampant inflation. And they say they don't have enough medicine and other supplies to meet patient needs. Recently, the Labour Court ruled that doctors must return to work, but they are still staying away. Teachers and other unions are closely watching the situation because they are considering stairways of their own. Reporter Kuzai Zinavashi has more details.
Doctors say they are baffled by the court's basis to rule they should go back to work. Dr. Tawanda Zwakada is with the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association.
Doctors were forced to act swiftly and decisively in a bid to secure a living wage. In response to this move, the employer chose to bring us before the courts, saying our actions amounted to illegal collective job action. The basis on which the Labour Court ruled out our action to be illegal remains a mystery to us, as reasons have not been given.
Zakada says lawyers for the doctors are seeking clarity on the reasons behind the ruling and may seek to get the ruling overturned. Government said the defiant doctors forced it to act. Minister of Higher and Tertiary Education, Professor Amon Murwira, spoke to journalists after a cabinet meeting yesterday.
Up until this stage, government has indeed gone out of its way to try and find an amicable solution by addressing the concerns of the medical doctors through constructive dialogue. However, given the uncompromising stance adopted by the medical doctors, government through the Health Service Board remains committed to following the dictates of the country's laws and has come to the point where it has to commence disciplinary proceedings for the striking doctors.
Minister of Health, Dr. Obadiah Moyo, explained the process of disciplinary action that will be carried out.
Whoever is not coming to work, they will not be paid. And since they are not at work, there will be the action related to absence from work. and that is going to be instituted strictly by the Health Services Board.
Moyo says they will stick to what the law detects in the disciplinary actions against doctors. Doctors say their salaries for October were withheld, further incapacitating them, but they say they remain more committed than ever to finding a lasting solution. As both parties struggle to find common ground, one issue they agree on is that the public is suffering due to the situation. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
Rights and education activists in Nigeria say all schools need to be registered with the government to avoid the sort of abuses uncovered in recent weeks. The Nigerian police force has closed several abusive facilities called rehabilitation centers. Reporter Gift Agiriga in Abuja tells us more.
Police have freed more than 1,000 adults and children in raids on four facilities that the proprietors called rehabilitation centers in the past 3 weeks. Most of those freed are men and boys ranging in age from 7 to 40, but at least 22 women were freed from one facility last week. The centers are described as Islamic schools, intended to educate and train wayward students with behavior problems. But police say those held inside were shackled, sexually assaulted, starved, and beaten. Assistant Commissioner of Police, who speaks for the Nigerian Police Force, Frank Mba, says the school operators have been arrested and charged to court. He said police are working with other authorities to determine the factors that have given rise to the emergence of these centers.
I agree that it is a major problem that needed to be tackled. We are working with community leaders, religious leaders, relevant government institutions and regulatory authorities to investigate further and to determine if there are still some of these institutions that are still existing in other states of the Federation.
Mba says the rescued students are being returned to their families and given medical checks. Many had wounds and infections because of the abuse they received. The rehabilitation centers, which were not registered with government, have been operating for years. Mba encouraged citizens to notify security agencies if they suspect any schools or centers are illegal. Mukhtar Modibo is an education activist with a community action organization, Connected Development. He says all schools need to be registered to prevent abusive facilities from going undiscovered.
And all these gatherings, including the Almajiri system, every other system of education in this country, not just the formal education, including the religious classes and what have you, should undergo registration.
Almajiris are informal Islamic schools. Usually impoverished parents send their sons to Almajiris to learn the Quran and other skills. The boys must beg on the streets to pay for their schooling. While public schooling is free, some families prefer the Almajiri schools for religious training. Almajiris are common in northern Nigeria. Muslim Rights Concern, a Nigerian organization focused on peace and human rights, estimates about 10 million children attend them. Sarah Danshoho is an activist working to improve the Almajiri system. She said Almajiri is an ancient tradition, but operators have abused the system.
The truth is that the Almajiri system, from the beginning, it was a very interesting activity to teach them how to do some skills and give back to the society. But now the narrative has changed. The so-called religious malams that take care of them now use them as money-making machines.
She says some of the schools have life-threatening effects on the children because they often are malnourished and they aren't given proper clothes and medical care. Ultimately, she says, many of the Almajiri students feel unloved, which makes it harder for them to connect with their society. Dan Shoho said that the schools pose as a problem both to Nigerians' education and security system. One big hazard is that many are encouraged to steal and harass people on the streets, and she says the children may be encouraged to join militant organizations. President Muhammadu Buhari, whose home state is Katsina, has said that he plans to ban almajiris eventually, but would not do so right away. The president, however, has directed the police to find all rehabilitation centers and disband them. The rehabilitation centers differ from almajiris in that parents typically pay to send their sons to them to correct bad behavior. For VOA News, this is Gift Agiriga from Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 680 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impuga, and at 21 minutes past the hour, here is a recap of our top stories. Zimbabwe's Minister of Higher and Tertiary Education threatens disciplinary action against doctors who are refusing to work. Botswana braces for a closely fought election on Wednesday. Protesters march in Khartoum and other cities to mark the October 1964 uprising that ended a dictatorship. And rights and education activists call for the destruction of all schools in Nigeria. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. American comedian and television host Ellen DeGeneres and her wife, Portia de Rossi, have raised over $5 million for gorilla conservation in Rwanda from the Gorilla Palooza fundraiser that included music performances by Chris Martin and Bruno Mars. The Rwandan government assures that the love of gorillas not only helps keep them alive, but also helps in the development of the country. Eugene Wimana has more details from Kigali, Rwanda.
$50,000
with Julia Roberts. Any
America's sweetheart.
The money raised will go into the Ellen Fund, which is dedicated to conservation efforts, particularly for Rwanda's mountain gorillas. The generous is building a university campus for gorilla conservation in Rwanda to continue research started by Diana Fosse and provide education and responsible terrorism linked to the primates.
We were hoping to raise $2 million. That didn't happen. We raised over $5 million. This is so important because there are only 1,000 mountain gorillas left.
The fact that there are only remaining a few mountain gorillas worldwide made the fundraising deal reasonable. This is James Corden, an English actor and singer.
Looking at a man who has been told tonight there are only 1,000 gorillas left. That is more viewers than Watch My Show, Bill, okay? This is technically the biggest audience I've ever played for. And are you going to let me down, Bill? The Bill I know wouldn't do that to me. He'd raise that paddle. $100,000.
Gorillas have changed the lives of people who live near Volcanoes National Park in northwest Rwanda. Some who once were poachers now earn their daily bread by conserving these endangered species. This is Mukam Hedivenansi. My husband used to carry spears, me a machete, with a bag to put in the meat of animals that we killed. But with the training and this project, we have changed our mindset. Now she makes traditional baskets for tourists and refers to poaching as a serious crime. Rwandan President Paul Kagame assures that Rwanda will keep benefiting from gorillas as they cooperate in conservation efforts.
The support of the local communities whom I have had the opportunity to express our thanks to, and also made sure that they benefit from this good cooperation.
Rwanda, a country with few natural resources underground, is collecting incredible revenues from gorilla tourism. The latest statistics from the Rwanda Development Board show that sales revenues from gorilla trekking in Volcanoes National Park has been growing over the years. Revenues grew by 25% in 2018 to $19.2 million from the previous year. 20% of the park revenues go to surrounding communities. Eugene Uimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
In African slums, boxing clubs are seen as a good way to keep young men off the streets, let them take out their frustrations through sport rather than crime, and provide a way out of poverty. In Uganda, though, one woman has stepped into the ring not only to win medals on the continent, but also empower young women to stay off the streets and defend themselves. Halima Athman reports from Kampala.
Helen Vareke was walking one night in Katanga slum, her Kampala neighborhood, when a young man approached her and started touching her. She says she didn't like boys touching her because if they did, the end result would be pregnancy and HIV. So when he groped me, says Vareke, I wanted to fight, but he beat me up. Vareke returned home with a bloody nose. She did not tell her mother about the attack or how she planned to deal with it. Vareke began sneaking out of the house early in the morning to train as a boxer. Her mother, Sarah Bagole, noticed Valike's disappearance acts and confronted her. She says she waited for Valike, and when she returned, she told her, Mama, I have knocked out a girl. Bagole said, What? You have knocked out a girl? And told her, You'll be beaten, but never come here crying. The day they beat your eye and pluck it out, it will be on you. Bagole says she wasn't happy at all. Vareke's mother warmed up to her daughter's boxing, though, as she kept training, competing, and winning. In August, at the African Games in Rabat, Morocco, she won a bronze medal, becoming Uganda's first medal-winning female boxer in 18 years. Vareke also trains other women, such as hairdresser Maureen Ajambo, to box for self-defense and to help young women stay off the streets. I see so many girls, says Ajambo. They are young, they drink booze, they get pregnant, some get HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. They can't take care of their child or themselves, she says. They take drugs, they take everything that gets them high, says Ajambo. It hurts me. Kampala's Katanga slum is home to 20,000 urban poor who live in crowded conditions and where women are often victims of crime. The coach at Katanga's Rhino Boxing Club, Innocent Kaparata, says more and more young women in the slum are joining the club. Most of those who come to train do it to seek revenge, he says. But I strive to take it out of them, says Kaparata, telling them we don't train boxers for revenge but to stay fit and healthy. Something else, he says, boxing is a business. You could get lucky and make some money. To help the women earn money quickly and so they can keep boxing, Vareke set up a tailoring workshop. Whether teaching how to punch a needle through cloth or an opponent in the ring, Vareke is empowering young women in Uganda's Katanga slum. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. And for latest developments on the continent, visit our website 24/7 at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Wakinja, and Chang, our engineer tonight, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, thousands have fled the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo following ethnic violence targeting the Banyamulenge community. What's behind the ethnic attacks in the DRC? We'll take a closer look on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.